All right, folks, and welcome back to the 1001 Arabian Nights. I'm your host, Aban Arikabi.
And I'm your host, Houston Rafai. And today we have our guest once again, Iman Nagy.
Thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be here.
No problem.
No problem. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Today, in this episode specifically, what we're going to be talking about is Christianity. Early Christianity from the time of its conception all the way to about the 7th century. Before the coming of the Muslims in the area. So everything from how it was developed, and then its development and how it changed and influenced the political scene in the Middle East and in the greater region.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So we're doing 600 years.
About, yeah, in 1 hour.
This is gonna be good.
In about an hour, hour and a half, yeah.
Oh, well, let's hope. Anyway, but anyways, I think, Iman, we wanted to start talking about, like, I think our audience is fairly familiar with the story of Jesus himself. I don't think we need to tread it over necessarily. Like, he came to Jerusalem, he was betrayed by Judas, and he was crucified, and then he rose 3 days later.
Yeah.
And that's like the final days of Jesus. Or you can go see that documentary by Mel Gibson and to get the accurate version, supposedly, right? Yeah. The one where, anyways, we're not going to get into that. So, what happens after he rises? What does the world look like just after Jesus is rising?
Okay, basically, I would argue that you have probably in this time a lot of people claiming to, or oh, I don't want to say claiming, a lot of miracle workers, let's say, performing miracles. To some degree, and people are following many of these miracle workers. And one of them happens to gain a very large following and his message happens to resonate deeply with people in Palestine, in that general area. And then you have, obviously, his followers who are now tasked with, and whether that tasking is self-inflicted or not, they begin to now prophesize and evangelize to the world, and spread this message that the Christ figure gave, and spread the philosophical meaning of his rising, as a sign that a divine being was. The divine manifestation took place, and that divine manifestation echoes the Judaic traditions, right? That where there are these very intense confrontations with the divine, as what happened with Moses, what happened with Noah, what happened with Abraham, right? So now you have this figure who is now in a very chaotic period of human history where Rome is now in control of most of the, you know, Western and Eastern world. And now this small following becomes very big and is now magically almost a threat to this empire. And I would say that is the most, in a nutshell way I could put it.
Okay.
Interesting.
Well, one thing I wanted to say was at that time, there were many prophets that were around, right?
Many.
So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd call them all prophets. Maybe.
People preaching, I guess, like prophecies or giving out, you know, religious.
Sure,
meetings.
Sure. Absolutely.
What made Jesus stand out from all of them?
This is the great question.
From
the historical standpoint, this is the great question, because you have so many, and you guys know I don't like the word cult, but you have so many cults, for lack of a better term, and you have so many miracle workers, magicians, prophecies, prophesizers, all kinds of magical, supernatural practitioners.
Yeah.
So why does the Jesus figure stand out? This is the great question of history.
I mean, a Christian would say it's because his message was true, right? That would be the argument.
Yeah. But then again, I think it's the stories associated with him, though. Isn't it like, okay, like he rose from the dead. This is something.
I'd say that... because his message was fair. It was probably the first time historically recognized that somebody was preaching for the rights of the least, the lowliest person. So you can imagine that at this chaotic point in history, that would be very appealing to the public, who are suffering a great deal, who don't necessarily have the best quality of life. There's, you know, these Roman overlords everywhere. And suddenly the individual is the center stage and can have a direct relationship with the divine, as opposed to going through a rabbi or going through a priest in a cultic situation. Now this message basically preaches that if you believe in the Christ figure, you believe in God directly, and you can have a relationship with God directly.
Interesting, because there's all that, we were discussing in the last episode how Judaism was sort of shifting at the same time, and that Christianity was born out of that shift away from, like, I guess, worship at the temple and worship through the authorities to worship sure. through these sort of unrecognized figures. And
this is the whole concept of the kingdom of heaven, right? Mm. Like, you don't need a temple anymore.
So in terms of concepts, how did Christianity change from Judaism to the point where we do discuss it as a separate religion?
Well, from the philosophical point of view, I would say that early Christianity reconfigured the spiritual universe and illustrated to people that there is no longer a concept of a chosen people. Now everybody can be included. Okay, so this is like a democratization of spirituality. Mm. So this is really important concept. And now in this democratization of spirituality, everyone is chosen. And everyone has the specific task of overcoming evil. Hmm. There's no longer this concept of this covenant. Maybe the covenant exists on a personal level now, as opposed to with a specific group of people. You have to keep this spiritual pact with God to overcome evil so that you can enter the kingdom of heaven.
This would explain why Christianity as a religion took on a much more expansionist role, I guess, than Judaism, no? Because Judaism doesn't emphasize on, there's no emphasis on converting people or anything, because, like you said, it's restricted to one people, the chosen people. And so
it's non-inclusive, basically.
Exactly, yeah. While Christianity, I guess, since, like you said, everybody can be a part of, I guess, the religion, then that's where you have like conversion efforts happening, no?
Right. Well, actually, I want to ask a question on that, because in my mind, my curiosity is, did Jesus make Christianity a Gentile religion, one that accepts and seeks out the Gentile, or was it Paul who was immediately after him? Do we know where it was? Whose origin point?
No, Jesus. Well, I mean, according to the New Testament. No, so basically, in the New Testament, it does mention that Christ says that the Gentiles are part of his kingdom. But he, at the same time, he doesn't knock the Jewish tradition. He doesn't say that Jews shouldn't be Jews and that they should be a part of his tradition. He just says, now I have this tradition that includes all people. And what's really important, I think, for viewers to understand is that the Christ message focused on the poor. It focused on the lowest class of people and told them that they were the holiest. It inverted the socioeconomic status of people spiritually. So now the poorest person is actually the most spiritually rich. Mm, so you can imagine how that would be very attractive to the majority of humanity in that realm.
But this also ties in with eschatology, no? Because, like, in a sense, it's like, you know, the end of times are coming, and the only way to make it is if you stay as a righteous person. If you're a righteous person, and you're virtuous, then you will be admitted into heaven in the last day, no? And so I think this also helped, or I guess, you know, gave people hope, I guess,
It's important to understand that at that time, there was a lot of what we call apocalyptic literature. Mm. And in that apocalyptic literature, it's very evident that in Greece, in the Middle East, in Egypt, in Babylon, wherever, people really thought the end of the world was very near, very near. So it's not like they're talking about abstract concepts in the future. To them, it was rather, I mean, I can imagine and infer that it was rather literal. So I agree with you that it would be very attractive. And if you're very poor and people are telling you, you're going to have everything in the afterlife all of a sudden. Yeah, 100%.
As long as you're righteous and you're virtuous, you're going to have it all, right? And so I think this kind of gave hope to people and kind of alleviated them. Alleviated people psychologically from their misery.
Exactly. And this leads into why there are now all these factions of different schools of thought. Because now the question is how to achieve such a thing. Now that Jesus is gone, right, or ascended, now you have all these philosophies, which I'll let Houston get into and break down. Because this is really the core of why all these schools of thought emerge. Because now we know what's going to happen. We don't know how we as individuals can get there.
So we're going to try to briefly go over the first three centuries of Christianity. And like, I think it's interesting to see that Christianity really emerged in a time when the Roman Empire became what it became. So like, it hit its borders, it hit its expansion, it had newly conquered and newly subjugated, because previously they would have been like client states, and now they'd really set their roots down and made their presence felt all over this massive empire and extracted wealth from that massive empire back to Rome itself at this period of time. We haven't gotten yet to the point where it became a mutually beneficial relationship. At this point in Jesus' life, this is all about extraction. And maybe even the mutually beneficial thing might be an exaggeration in later centuries. But in this case, it's all about extraction. And so people are desperate, and other people have found their wealth in working with the enemy, in working with this foreign power. So there's all that stuff going on at the same time. While Christianity emerges out of this period of time, we eventually get to the crises of the Middle East that came out in the next few centuries. For example, the destruction and the wars between the Jews and the Romans, which sent the communities of both Christians and Jews scattered across the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And so in that sphere where they're all a bunch of little communities all over the place, and even Paul, when he's setting up little communities all over the place, each one of them is distinct in their own way, but they're not really codified in any way. They are part of this tradition that's more... it's difficult to classify any of them as anything, because the tradition is evolving naturally amongst its adherents, underground, away from the authorities.
Yeah.
So Christianity stayed a pretty small religion, maybe 1 or 2% of the Roman Empire's total population for most of that 300 years. And then during the crisis of the third century, most historians that I've heard about have talked about how the crisis of the third century really expanded Christianity's reach during that period, because it was, again, the crisis and generation-long just terrible time for everybody when the world did feel like it was falling apart. So that in that kind of context, Christianity's message, eschatology?
Yeah.
That message really can sell in a world that does feel like it's falling apart, and the powers that be do not have control. By the end of the crisis of the third century, they probably made up about 10% of the population of the empire, a huge minority, not like majority by any means, but a huge percentage. And in a lot of urban places, they were starting to hit like almost majority levels of the population. So at this point, it has become a major religion of the empire and a major problem. And that's when the real big crackdown starts happening against Christianity and all its different sects and groups that haven't really formed yet. And each Christian community would have their underground organization themselves. They would have priests and then a bishop, and the bishop would be like the highest authority in that area, and there would be nothing above them. And it was a very informal kind of arrangement. So all of that is kind of what the first two centuries, and then we get to after the crisis of the third century and this reorganization of the Roman Empire into what it would be later on. And it would eventually evolve into what we now call the Byzantine Empire in the way that things work. So prior to the crisis of the third century and the reorganization, the emperor was the principate. He was the first citizen. There was still this understanding of the emperor as sort of a republican figure.
Yeah.
Afterwards, they used the word dominus, which is the way, it's a word that would be used for a slave to address his master. So it'd be there was a new relationship which tried to elevate the emperor even further above what they had been in the previous centuries. So there's like this divine position that the emperor is like increasingly taking.
I think they demand like religious
more than ever.
Yeah, more religious obedience and, or from
exactly
from the people, right?
And more than ever, the emperors felt threatened by any challenge to their authority in the form of a Christian or Jewish refusal to bow to the emperor's will.
Yeah.
Now the Jews, they kind of came to arrangements with the Roman Empire eventually by this point, and they had become less of a political threat, but the Christians had become a massive political threat. More than ever in this period of time was really when the persecutions happened, when the Roman Empire was trying to reestablish its authority in a way where the emperors were now divine, but not in a religious, like Christian sense. They were divine in a pagan sense.
Yeah.
And the empire were their subjects, peoples, in a way that like was the conception had changed somewhat. In referring to the leader of the Roman Empire no longer as the first citizen, but the Lord, your Lord, Dominus.
The God King.
Yeah, the God King, essentially. But a God King without really the authority that one might expect. So that really sets the stage for essentially like the Christianity had become the majority religion in a few places. For example, Armenia and Ethiopia, these nations became Christian nations before Rome did. But it really took off with the series of Roman emperors that would come about from Constantine and his dynasty and how he seized power. So
it's also, I think it's really important to also understand that underneath all of this that's going on, that it's very legitimate from the political, like historical standpoint. This is also the rise of like esoteric knowledge and hidden knowledge, and how these particular rulers, these bishops, these churches of nations now kind of disseminate the religion from the point of view that they, the highest leaders, contain this very esoteric spiritual knowledge, which is how they're able, I would argue, to sway such a large amount of people into believing and practicing and following their traditions and establishing new traditions. And this is a huge threat to the state, because the state can't compete with hidden knowledge.
Right.
The state can't compete with what it doesn't know.
And actually, that's really great setup for the story that is often described for how Christianity became the religion of Constantine and therefore the empire. And it's, he always had people around him who were Christian. So he actually got proclaimed emperor up in the town that would eventually become York in Northern England. And I found that out when I visited. Because they're very proud of the fact that Constantine was proclaimed emperor in their city, you know. But he was in charge of basically France and Britain at this point, and he was marching down to Italy to go fight his rival. I'm not going to get into the details of the Civil War because it doesn't really matter. But essentially, he's fighting his rival, and he has all of these like a certain number of priests and family members. I can't remember the name of the priest. But basically, they're trying to convince him that in order to win, you must become a godly man. You must open your heart up to God, essentially. Then he will give you divine favor and become the righteous arm of his, you know, of his vanquishing, because Constantine was more sympathetic to Christianity because his family were Christians, but he himself was not a Christian. So they felt that he was their best in to essentially ending the age of oppression against the Christians and really bringing the kingdom of God upon earth, essentially. So, and
which is interesting because it's the complete opposite of what Christ taught.
Exactly. But Constantine, essentially the night before his battle, with the battle which we call the Milvian Bridge, the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And Constantine, in his vision before the battle, saw that God sent him a sign in the sky, and by this sign, you will conquer. And in that sign was the Cairo. So it's very simple. Actually, it's very interesting because Christianity having the symbol of the cross is not at all like set in stone at any point up until much later. The Cairo was probably much more, especially in this right after this period, was probably a much more iconic symbol of Christianity, because it was associated with the emperor as well. So the Cairo is the letters X and P, basically the way they look. And it's the two first letters of the word Christ.
Yeah.
So yeah, so if you ever go
to- Which is also a total pagan nod to pagan traditions as well. Because so in paganism, and I don't like to group all of it, but basically, you know, the reading of signs is huge. It's probably the core of pagan tradition in that area, is having signs in the sky, reading the livers of animals, divine prophesizing, all these things. So it's very much in line with what one would have to do to convince pagans out of their religion into a new one by using their own methodology, basically.
Yeah, because I mean, monotheistic religions usually stand against quote unquote superstitious practices, no? And so this kind of would be
I mean, in Judaism, like for example, God appears to Moses. I wouldn't say God appears. I don't know if it's God or if it's the angels or whatever, but supernatural events happen, but they're not distinctive. They're not distinctive, like you're saying, Houston, like specific letters or something. It's something very abstract. It's something supernatural that can't be read. That's why I think that what happened with Constantine is a nod to paganism and paganistic beliefs, because that's exactly the kind of thing that they'd be looking for in the sky, amongst the birds, you know, things like that, things of that nature.
I'm so glad you say that, because two important things about the battle to get people's minds around this. Constantine essentially the next morning runs out of his tent and he starts declaring and ordering all his men. He takes a paintbrush and a white paint on all their shields, and he starts ordering them to paint the symbol on their shields and say, by this sign we will win. And, you know, it's sometimes portrayed as like the sacrilegious thing that his soldiers have to do for him. And it's sometimes portrayed as something that inspires the men and like brings their hearts into it, you know? So it's very interesting that like, it probably was a bit of both, to be honest, but the fact that it filled that tradition of signs of victory was probably the clincher for at least inspiring his men to fight properly. And he was definitely the underdog in the fight, especially since the reason why it's called the Battle of the Milvian Bridge was because his opponent, the other emperor who was in charge of Rome at the time, had rigged the bridge between them. He was going to bait Constantine into trying to cross that bridge with a small group of men and then break the bridge while half his men are across and destroy his army. But instead what happens was the bridge jammed, and the other emperor tried to come in to fix it and try to fight off the invasion or something along the line, and it collapsed when he was on it.
That's divine intervention right there.
Exactly. So that's how it's often portrayed.
This sounds a lot like the story of Moses and Pharaoh. Mm. No, I mean, this is kind of what it reminded me of, right? When he crosses over on the Red Sea, and then the sea just closes on into him.
Exactly. But I think we spent a little bit too much time in Europe at this point, so we're going to be on to the next topic, which is going to be how Christianity, because at this point in time, Christianity is primarily a Middle Eastern religion, and it would remain so right up until like probably 1,000 years ago, right up until probably 1,000 years ago, because a significant portion of the Christian, like the population of the Middle East was Christian. Up until like 1,000 years, it was probably the majority. And essentially, most of the like big like changes in Christianity mostly came out of the Middle East. Like, for example, the monastic tradition was distinctly an Egyptian and Assyrian tradition that that came about from the desert fathers, as they call them. These men who would go out in the desert and create these orders and create these religious movements there.
Yeah.
Both before and after Constantine, including a guy like Saint Simeon, who like sat on a pillar for like 40 years or something.
Yeah, he
was crazy. And then like a bunch of people copied him and stood on.
Hung himself from a tree. No.
Now, I don't know about that one.
Yeah, well, I remember one of them hung himself from a tree. But yeah, this is asceticism.
Yeah, asceticism.
This is very Christian.
Right.
Right.
So not to get too distracted with all the interesting tidbits, what is interesting with Constantine's story is the second part of his relationship to Christianity is what happens during his rule. So he takes over the whole empire and he's trying to reorganize it into an empire of what it would eventually become. So the Dominus wasn't just the Dominus, it was also the Dominus with Christianity. So it's like the word Lord being referred to God and all the rest of it. And there's a God on earth essentially and a God in heaven. And he's the one on earth is subordinate to the one on heaven, but he's halfway between.
That's why monasticism and asceticism become so attractive.
Mm.
It's because you can go out into the desert and be away from all of this stuff, and you can you can function freely and you can preach freely without Roman guards everywhere overhearing you, without basically the state's big brother, right?
Yeah.
Making sure that you're in line.
I mean, we still have this like desire that a lot of people have to like break away from the world that it is today. Like, you have these off the grid communities. A lot of them are religious. The Amish have been a long term version of that. You know, very benign version of it. But there's also the crazies like
Ruby. This is the prophetic tradition in the most ancient religions in the world. You can't be around humanity to get close to God. You have to go into God's country.
Right.
Basically, which is away from
humanity.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's a similar idea that motivates a lot of people to like go out into the world and join these special cultic type communities, like the ones in Waco, or don't get too political, but the ones in the West Bank or the ones in like the Islamic State and the rest of it. It's these people wanting to go to where God's country is, basically.
Yeah. But
it's a good place for you to really latch on to an indoctrinated belief, and then you can come back into the world with a specific mission in mind, because you've been so inundated with the natural world and not and the whatever message is being prophesized to you. There's probably a lot of specific, you know, very deliberate kind of training that goes on in these ascetic and monastic traditions, where you see the world differently and you come in with new eyes. So it's easier maybe, or maybe not, to come back into, say, like the concept of Babylon, for example, and see it as a completely different state, which ties in very specifically to why Christianity becomes so popular. Because now you see the world through this concept of evil and sin and righteousness and spiritual warfare, and everything kind of becomes a manifestation of that. So as you're talking about the expansion of Rome and the expansion of empirical identity, people on the ground, the normal people, are starting to see that as the spiritual manifestation of sin, of righteousness, of this and of that.
Mm. Yeah. And essentially trying to perfect the religion in this way, I think is very much going to like segue into the next topic, which is basically Constantine, when he let all these bishops kind of come out of the woodworks and become public and official and recognized figures in the empire, and like almost like almost but not quite state employees. Like, they would start covering some of the costs. And for example, it was very, very friendly to Christianity. Again, he didn't convert until his deathbed, but he might as well have at this point, because he was not a very good Christian, but one who was at least dedicated enough to supporting the religion at this point in time, especially when
that's he became... story anyway. That's not a historical fact. We don't know when he converted or when
he when he converted. But it is possible that he believed that if he converted towards the end of his life, officially, he would have his sins removed, especially those sins that he would require to be emperor. Like, that's the one of these versions of the story. But regardless of that, what ends up happening is some of the bishops and some of the priests coming out of the woodworks disagreed a lot. They disagreed a lot, as religious leaders tend to do. And one of whom, a very prominent one out of Alexandria, was named Arius. Now, he wasn't the bishop of Alexandria, but he was a very prominent priest there. And during the reign of Constantine, he started preaching a specific doctrine that would become known as Arianism. And not in that, Arian kind of, never mind. That word has a bad connotation. But in this case, it's Arianism. And it is that God, because he created the Son and beget the Son, is superior to God the Son. So God the Father, because he beget the God the Son, is superior, and he should be the focus of worship. That was his point.
And this is important to understand, that why these specific traditions come up is because Christianity does not completely subsume cultural tradition. It gets synthesized with indigenous belief. And that was probably an indigenous belief that was then synthesized into that kind of Christianity. Yeah. It's important to understand that. Same with the Armenian church, same with the Ethiopian church. But anyway, sorry, go on.
I wouldn't know whether or not it would or wouldn't, but I would not disagree with you that that's very possible. But it became very popular to the point where there was fights breaking out between those who agreed with him and those who didn't. And it eventually became a big enough issue that they started excommunicating each other. So the preacher, his preaching caused riots in Alexandria, one of the most prominent cities in the empire. Excommunications started. All of this is starting to worry Constantine, who wants the Christian church to become a powerful entity. And they can't do that if they're constantly breaking apart and fighting. So he comes up with the idea of... essentially, he has a bunch of fair and unfair trials of Arius, and eventually he says, screw it, what we're going to do is we're going to gather every one of the bishops, all of the representatives from across the empire, all the Christian representatives in Nicaea, to have a council and finally knock out an actual Bible. Because at this point, they don't even have a written Bible that is codified. It's all just traditions, loose traditions that people follow or don't follow. There's no actual codification of any of this. So
that's why Alexandria is so important. Alexandria is the city of scrolls. It has every single document, Coptic document, every single document existed in Alexandria. That's why it's the focal point, why they had to, it makes perfect sense why they would be fighting there.
It is. And it was also the heart of Christianity. It was probably the most Christian of all the major cities at this point. And Egyptian Christianity at this point was probably one of the more radical as well, because there was a lot of fighting with the pagans at this point in time. A lot of fighting with the pagans, to the point where I don't know when Hypatia was killed, but Hypatia was the head of the Library of Alexandria is closer to a university than a library at this point in time. And she was essentially targeted by some of the priests in the city for killing, because her teaching, she was accused of corrupting the Roman governor essentially at the time, which wasn't true at all. She was an advisor to the
Math. She was teaching math and science, and they thought it wasn't Christian. It wasn't even that deep. She was just teaching math and science, and they thought that it was heresy and that it was pagan. Also,
their excuse for finally killing her was because the Roman governor had basically cracked down on them, and they blamed her because she was
an excellent movie, by the way.
There's a movie called Hypatia. Yeah, people should watch it. Anyways, not to get too distracted, they finally get a Council of Nicaea together. Arius makes this case, but he's basically ninja'd out of being influential at all. And in this Council of Nicaea, he was eventually excommunicated and his doctrine was thrown out as any legitimacy. An interesting side to note, one of the bishops who was, many of these bishops had existed and been young priests during the time of the persecution. So these were considered very tough, very like noble men who had survived like the worst of the persecutions of Christianity. One of whom was a guy named Saint Nicholas, which you might know for his other associations. And he is famed for having punched Arius in the face at the Council of Nicaea. So the memes of Arius getting punched in the face by Santa Claus are on the internet and should be viewed, is what I'm saying. Anyways.
You're saying they're historically accurate.
I know they're not historically accurate. They just make me chuckle, okay? Let me have my fun.
No. I said that what you just argued makes sense and that meme is historically accurate.
The meme is historically accurate. The red coat, perhaps not.
I wasn't there.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't there. Actually, red coat, maybe actually red was a very common color. Never mind.
Cultish, to be honest. Now that
winter clothing would be inaccurate. I'll give him that. The winter clothing is inaccurate. Nicaea is in Turkey. Nicaea is in like a northwestern Turkey, not far from Istanbul. Point is, which isn't that hot, but whatever. So a bunch of petty politics happened here that basically screwed him out of his position. But Arius and his supporters remained popular and remained influential across the empire. And crucially, the key point here is he sent some of his followers after his death went north to the Germanic tribes across the Rhine and the Danube to convert the Germans or the Germanic tribes of various types, and they succeeded. So the Christianity that took hold amongst the German tribes was not the Christianity of the empire. It was a rival religion, which is very important for later Roman history. All because of one Egyptian priest who got punched in the face by Santa Claus. Can't make this up. So that was in the period of around 300, 330. We skip ahead to another century where things get interesting again. Well, it's always interesting, but like important to the history of Christianity. And we get to something called the Nestorian Schism. So the Nestorian Schism, I have to explain in like very simple terms. So there was this Archbishop of Constantinople named Nestorius, rather, who, when asked the question of what Jesus' divine nature was, we used a metaphor to try to explain that he was two separate natures. So the Bible says that he's both a man and God. So what does that look like? What is the details of that? Was essentially the question. And he was trying to answer by saying that the Christ was two separate natures. Jesus and the Christ, the holy, the divine and the human, what's the other word? I'm trying to think about it. Like, what's the opposite of divine?
Normal or human.
Like the
mortal, I guess.
The mortal, I don't know. Yeah. Point is, he had two separate natures, one of which died on the cross and was buried, basically, like his body disappeared, but his divinity continued. So that was Nestorian's take on it. But this became extremely controversial because it went in the face of what other priests and bishops had been arguing for well over a couple centuries at this point, that Jesus had one nature, both divine and human. And then others would split the difference and say that it was actually one nature, but a mix. So there was only one nature to Jesus, and it was mostly divine, but in a human vessel. So all of this is...
Do you see a trend here?
What? What's the trend?
There's a very, very obvious trend that at this point, like, everything we've talked about up until this point, we only talked about the message of Christ during the time of Christ.
Yes.
And all of this is because of Paul and Paul's evangelism and how he essentially warped the idea of Christianity into becoming about Jesus, the figure.
Right. So Jesus, like your argument, and you mentioned this before, actually, that Jesus, his message should have been the point, but instead Jesus, the figure, became the point of the religion. And that's
I think that's directly related to Paul's teachings, because now it's no longer about that. Right. And what does that lay the grounds for?
Bad things.
Oh, bad. I mean, too much argumentation about the nature of his being. And what's really important to understand is that he specifically addressed that and told people to never mind about that.
Yeah, but because he said never mind, everybody ended up arguing because he never gave them an answer.
True.
Can't do that. Can't do that. The nerds will argue.
Just like in Islamic tradition, after the prophet dies.
Yeah, instead of focusing on the message, they focus on who's going to...
Well, because he doesn't name a leader. Now it's like, oh, forget the message.
Well, I mean, certain Muslims think that they did name a leader. It's others don't. We're going to get to that in a future episode.
But even then, yeah, no, I do get the point.
Yeah. Honestly, I would say that, like, the distinction that we just described between the different sects or these different opinions... A lot of modern readers, even the religious ones, would say, I don't really see what the big difference is and why this would cause such a rift. But at the time...
There is a big distinction that does cause a big rift. And I don't know if you want me to get into talking about it, but it has to do with the Book of Daniel.
Okay. Is it part of the...
You can decide... Yeah, I mean, it's what a lot of them used to... as the basis of their argumentation.
Okay, then get into it. I'm curious.
And you can, I can talk about it. You can decide if you want to put it in or not.
Go for it.
Go for it.
It's this concept of the Son of Man and whether Jesus Christ, because he says specifically that he's not the Son of God, that he's the Son of Man. And this is talked about heavily in the Nestorian Schism. And this is the foundation of why they start screaming and yelling at each other all the time. And the source of this is in the Book of Daniel, where this is the first mention of Christ being a savior figure, a savior figure will come, and that this savior figure is the Son of Man, and it never says Son of God.
Okay.
Interesting.
And you can see how this ideology is echoed in, like, later in Catholicism, right? Where now we're talking about the nature of the spiritual relationship of the soul of Christ and the Holy Trinity.
Right.
Where philosophically these religious leaders are trying to explicate the divine nature of this Christ figure. But the origin of this ideology, I would argue, is from the Book of Daniel and this mentioning of the savior figure who says he's the Son of Man. And to understand what the Son of Man has to do with the nature of sin and what the nature of reality is. And basically, to keep it brief, in Daniel has a lot of dreams. And in one of his dreams, there is this figure of a throne in the sky, and the throne that's in the sky is empty. And why is it empty? Because it has to be filled by the Son of Man. And the Son of Man has to overcome sin in the world. And so this has to do with man's relationship with God. Man, not the Christ, but man as in us, as in humanity, being the divine children of God. And if we're the divine children of God, then the Christ figure also, I guess this is where they start arguing about the nature of Christ. You can see how this would open a million doors into argumentation, and how everybody's different interpretation about what this means would influence this Nestorian schism about the divine nature of man and Christ. and whether Christ is man.
Okay, because is it to see, like, if Jesus Christ is actually that figure who's going to fulfill that prophecy or sit on that throne?
Exactly.
Okay.
And when he sits on that throne,
yeah,
this ties again into Judaism. And it's like, it's as if this covenant is now completed.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished.
It makes sense. It makes sense why they would schism over that, because then if Jesus does turn out to be that figure, then I guess that's how you can attain salvation and heaven, right?
And it's, this is also why he has to die. This is why he has to die. He has to die to be resurrected, to go into the throne, to ascend to the throne in heaven.
It's like you want to make sure that you're praying to the right thing, right?
Right. So, exactly. So in terms of the schism, what we could say is that some members of different groups would argue that the others are taking away from that very important figure of sacrifice by saying,
well,
that,
yeah, they're citing, which is also really interesting, they're citing Judaic scriptures as well to validate their arguments about the nature of divinity.
Interesting.
And you can see how this also directly influences a lot of esoteric movements in that time.
I would also like to highlight that all of this is happening kind of in Constantinople when this really starts to break out as a major problem. At the very same time that Nestorius is fighting with different elements of the religious establishment in Constantinople over this very particular question, and especially citing the Book of Daniel, Attila the Hun is burning the ever-loving everything out of the Balkans at this very moment. And he reaches within a day's ride of the city during this very period. Attila the Hun, the great scourge of Europe. So it's very interesting to see that this was the debate occurring at the time, which felt almost separate from what was going on with Attila, but might not be. Like, such an apocalyptic kind of invasion. At the time, it would have been seen as apocalyptic, especially from somebody like Attila the Hun. And the Huns were an especially scary people who scared the living hell out of the Germans and the other tribes. Like, we've done archaeological excavations, and you know what they used to do? The Huns, the warriors, would literally mold their heads, like the children's head, to be conical. And, like, it made them almost like an alien-looking people, too. Because they like morph their heads in a way that like they thought looked good, but the rest of the world thought looked incredibly weird and intimidating, and their style of warfare was unmatched. So
very ancient tradition. A lot of cultures did that,
but not in the Mediterranean basin. So that's the thing; it would be very foreign to them.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
So is also the embodiment of evil on Earth.
Exactly,
well.
The scourge of God.
From the Christian, religious Christian point of view, this is the embodiment of sin and evil, and the, you know, now you have figures of Satan and the devil, and you have manifestations of that kind of evil on Earth. So you can imagine how people like Attila influenced what hell would look like for these people as well, and how that would in turn make people want to convert even more.
Exactly. And fight over, by this point, most people had converted to Christianity, but actually reinvest themselves in the religion and actually fight over specific tenets of the religion in a way that's very important, because it feels very immediate, because the world is in threat from this like divine hellish figure. Like the four horsemen of the apocalypse have come, sort of thing. And I guess that's a lot of the background for why this split occurs, in fact. And this actually didn't really help, actually, because this split would really help to carry along the decline of the empire, because significant portions of the population started splitting off into these factions. Into these various factions. So we're going to get into that a little bit, because at first it's not geographically like distinct, like these different religious traditions that emerge out of the Nestorian Schism, which is what this event is called. It's around 430 to 450 is when the Nestorian Schism really happens. After this, the lines of the map are really drawn. But in that 20-year space, this is what's going on at the time. So you have the Monophysite / Miaphysite tradition, which argues the one divine nature of Jesus, which is a tradition that it caused more hatred between Christians than Christians had towards the pagans, almost. And it was very destructive for the internal stability of the empire. After the Council of Chalcedon, which was the final council that tried to settle this issue, the Council of Chalcedon gave its name to the majority opinion of the Western and Greek churches. So let's say like from Turkey-ish to Greece to like the Western Roman Empire, that area took on the Chalcedonian tradition. So the opinion of the Council of Chalcedon and
the creed,
the Chalcedonian creed. And that tradition would become the Catholic and Orthodox churches, the mainstream Greek Orthodox and Catholic churches, which would later split off into a million things anyways. But at that point, that was one thing. And that would become, in 450, that would become the official creed of the empire. And it would eventually become the classical Trinity and all the things that are familiar with a lot of Western Christians. And the reason why we're bringing up this schism in particular is because it had a major impact on Middle Eastern Christianity, because there's where things did split and there wasn't a unified church and there were different factions. So we bring up the Miaphysite tradition, which would become, and based on the doctrine that Christ is both divine and human in the same body, was the Miaphysite change of the Monophysite tradition. So the Monophysites believe that Jesus was just divine. The Miaphysites changed it to being divine and human in the same body. This would become the traditions of Oriental Orthodox, is what is often they're grouped under. And this is the Orthodox, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, the Eritrean Orthodox, the Coptic Church of Egypt, the Syriac Orthodox Church, the Indian Orthodox Church, and the Malabar Independent Syrian Church, which is a very interesting group of like Christians who landed in like southern India and like survived for like 1,000 years as like this little religion in Kochi, basically. Anyways, that's all beside the point. This
Indian
was the
Christianity as well is really interesting and very often overlooked.
And they were the first Christian church in India, is to be clear with them.
I said Nubian.
No, the Nubian church was, I think, under the same umbrella as well. The Nubian church eventually gets subsumed into the Coptic and Ethiopian churches, don't they?
No way. No
okay. Way. So, but they were part of this Oriental Orthodox tradition, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that there were a lot of, I don't think it's fair to umbrella them in such a way. Because a lot of them, all these individual churches or institutions, I would say it's the formation of institution, and the formations of these institutions were all built on the foundation of indigenous belief.
True.
And it's very interesting that the indigenous belief is what made them distinct from each other and not the kinds of Christianity that they followed.
That's
the way I would phrase it.
That point is taken, and there's a reason why these churches are different from one another. It's not like the one Miaphysite church, but at the same time, they follow the Miaphysite view of Jesus, is the better way of putting it, I guess.
Sure, but yes and no, and it's really interesting to, if we were to examine why. If, like case by case basis, not that we have the time to do such things.
No, we don't.
But if one were to do that, like if you were to compare and contrast, say the Tewahedo and the Nubian Orthodox Church what the foundations of their indigenous beliefs and how those survived into the tradition. And it would really illustrate to you why the Miaphysite or what's the other one, sorry?
Monophysite?
Monophysite or Miaphysite, right. So basically, two souls or not, or whatever. Multi-spiritual being or unispiritual being.
Yeah.
Why indigenous beliefs influenced that is really interesting to think about, because we're talking about what are the areas we're talking about? We're talking about the most ancient places on earth,
right?
With the most ancient cultures, I'm saying.
Although I do want to just give our audience sort of like an understanding of the geography, just to give them like the last little bit of this rundown. So Nestorian Christianity, which is the third type. So we got the Miaphysite, the Chalcedonians, and then we got the Nestorian Christians, and they would become known as the Church of the East. So we got the Oriental Orthodox Church, the Orthodox Catholic Church, which is the Empire's church. And then you get the Church of the East, which really started to expand out of the Empire into the East, basically all the way through the Iranian Empire. So there's, at this point, we are talking about the Sasanian Iranian Empire, the House of Sasan, as they call it. And they gave refuge to this version of Christianity that was in opposition to the Roman emperors. So they're basically trying to screw with them and giving refuge to this sect of Christianity that the empire is trying to wipe out because it's a threat. And they're giving, so it becomes the religion of the Assyrian people of what is now northern Iraq, which is under the tutelage of the Iranian Empire. And it would become the Christianity that was most dominant in Iraq and Iran, in Mesopotamia and Iran, and into the Central Asia in the next coming centuries. It wouldn't become the dominant religion, but it would become a very important minority religion and the majority religion in certain areas, especially in northern Mesopotamia, where it would thrive as the Church of the East, as the Assyrian Church. And it was centered around a town called Nisibis, which actually to this day is a very important town at the fracturing point between Turkey, which has Nisibis, the old center, and the much bigger city that where the Assyrians fled to and the Kurds fled to. So right now it's actually kind of going to be a central place in the Middle East for a very long time. But anyways, this, and critically, the Miaphysite tradition would become the religion of Ibn Harith Ibn Jabalah, who will be a very important figure in the next coming stories, and the Ghassanid tribe, the Ghassanid kingdom, would at least officially convert to the Miaphysite tradition in opposition to the Church of Rome. The Church of Rome was not the majority in Syria. In Syria and in Egypt, the majority religion was the Miaphysite creed, whereas the Christians of Mesopotamia would be the Nestorian Christians, including those who would be sheltered by the Lachmid tribe, the Manu Lachmid, the Banu Lachm.
Beni Lachm, yeah.
And they would be, they would have a strong relationship with, at first, the Iranian Shahs, and then they would be persecuted by the Iranian Shahs. So that's trying to set up what the different Christianities of the Middle East look like at this point. Mesopotamia had a strong presence of Nestorians, Syria and Egypt had a strong presence of Miaphysites, and the Empire of Rome, while there were Chalcedonian and Chalcedonian being synonymous with Orthodox practitioners in those regions, they were a minority and they were ruling over Christians who were bucking against the creed of Rome and the creed of the empire, of the emperor. And that would set the stage for why, at least partially why, those areas became easier to take away from the empire, at least like politically. And I think we can also end off on our little discussion of how the Arabs actually got converted. So there's different accounts to how the Arab tribes, because at this point the Arabs were the people of the desert surrounding the lands of Syria, the lands of the Levant, as we like more neutrally call them. And so there would be the Aramaic-speaking Syria, and then the Arabic-speaking tribes in the desert who would interact with each other. So there's a sort of bilingual belt around the meeting point, you know? Yeah. So when they tried to convert the Arabs who were clients of Rome to this rival Christian religion, there's different accounts to how it happened. Do you want to take a stab at it?
Sure. I mean, well, there's a full quote right there. It says that there are many peoples between the Tigris and the Euphrates in the land of Mesopotamia who lived in tents and were barbarous and warlike. Numerous were their superstitions, and they were the most ignorant of all peoples of the earth until the moment when the light of Christ came to them. This is the holy Ahudeme. The holy Ahudeme set himself with great patience to visit all the camps of the Arabs, instructing them and teaching them in many sermons. So I guess this figure, Ahudeme, must have been a priest who was sent to convert the Arabs. He had priests come from many regions in order to establish in every tribe a priest and a deacon. He founded churches and named them after tribal chiefs so that they could support them. Thus, he inclined the hearts of the Arabs to the love of God and particularly to giving to the needy. Their alms extended to all men in all places, but especially to the holy monasteries. Nor do they confine their piety to making gifts to churches, monks, poor, and strangers, but they love fasting and ascetic life more than any other Christians. And I think this is related to indigenous indigenous practices, because I know the Arabs, even prior to Islam, would practice, you know, in certain months what they would fast, right? And so this is
Sunnah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, just the whole concept of having like a holy month. I believe before Ramadan, it was before Ramadan, I think it was Sha'ban, maybe.
There was a number of holy months because different areas would celebrate them, and you travel to different, like, almost like festivals / religious events. And in this quote, they finish off by talking about and this one's going to be very, but they love fasting and the ascetic life more than any other Christians, to such an extent that they begin 40 days fast a week earlier than others.
Yeah.
Many of them eat no bread during the whole time of the fast, not only the men, but also many women.
Yeah. This must have been one of those indigenous practices that, you know, that got synced. It was a synchronization that got
synchronization.
That got syncretized with Christianity.
I mean, you don't need to. It's very hard for people to observe that in their own culture, in their own religion, too. Like, they just see it as part of the religion as a whole. But go travel in Latin America and see what indigenous Christianity looks like. I mean, there's a lot of influences of indigenous religions there. A lot.
100%.
The Mexico is
also very socioeconomic. I mean, it's very clearly that this entire commentary, you could look at it from a total socioeconomic standpoint, almost even from a capitalist standpoint, that this is a way. Yeah, I mean, think about it. Yeah. This is how can we adapt our religion to fit in with the indigenous beliefs of these people?
Right, you're trying to sell them this idea, and you have to make it something that they can approach.
I mean, it says so right here. He founded churches and named them after tribal chiefs so that they would support them.
Which was probably a local tradition in its own way.
100%. Yeah. This is typical, typically Arab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is clearly part of that process that Iman is talking about. And people, like, seriously, one of the weirdest things that I find is that Christianity is an indigenous Middle Eastern religion. It is from that area. It goes to Europe, becomes sort of synonymous with European culture, and then there's cultural artifacts that are taken from Europe back by Christians to the Middle East. So, for example, a Christmas tree. There's Christmas trees in Syria and Lebanon. That makes no sense. That's not at all a tradition that they ever did. like dressing up with, like they have cedars, but like they don't have like pine trees in the same way, and cutting it down to like put it up in your house, like makes no sense. That is all very recent in the last century.
Yeah.
No, like best case scenario in the last century. And even outside of Germany, it's no more than 200 years old in like the rest of the Christian world. So this like one cultural artifact that is originally a pagan tradition has become this universal Christian slash capitalist, because now those are the same thing, weirdly enough, thing around the world.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, you can also, even Islam didn't escape syncretization. I mean, if you look at just like, well, if you've ever read Ibn Khaldun or Ibn Battuta, and when they start speaking about other cultures that they visited, whether it be in sub-Saharan Africa or in India or in Pakistan, you know, there's a lot of these indigenous cultures that, you know, kind of merged or got integrated into Islam. I mean, Sufism is one of them. It's the reason why Sufism got such a stronghold in the Indian Pakistani region. Mm-hmm. It's because Sufism focuses a lot on, you know, the ascetic, right? The ascetic, the spirituality, and all that stuff.
Personal relationship with God.
And this is something that that was already present in Hinduism, right? I mean, this is where you get all these traditions.
And as you said, the personal relationship, but specifically through ecstatic experience.
Yeah,
true.
And this was already present prior to Islam in that region. And so this is why Sufism, you know, really spread over there, because it speaks to them, it relates to them.
Absolutely. But we have to also like not go too far the other way and say that the religion does change the culture a lot when it comes
to
a cultural revolution. So for example,
it's a two-way street. That's what I'm trying to say.
South Asia, Islam is
Miaphysites and Monaphysites arguing about this, like whether it's one way or whether it's two-natured in the same manifestation.
We're having a fun discussion, okay? And in this case, when you're talking about like South Asia, for example, one of the things that is one of the core aspects to South Asian culture is the caste system.
Yeah.
And Islam, and to an extent Christianity and some of the other religions, are built on breaking away from this very rigid, very old system that is very hard to get away from.
And also not because their entire institution is built on a spiritual caste.
True.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
But one who was born a lowly person could rise. And that's what is revolutionary sometimes, especially when a new religion comes into town.
You don't see it too often. You don't see many destitute popes. But even then,
it's still, there's just the possibility that, just the fact that this is possible is what makes it so attractive. I mean, this is what Christianity did to people. It kind of gave them that power that, okay, like, if you do this right, then you will be saved. Then you can rise up. You know what I mean?
But not in this life.
Reformation. For example, the Reformation.
Sure. Debatable.
Let's talk about the Reformation for a second, because like Martin Luther was making this argument. Like it's interesting that you see this like rigid religious tradition that has become somewhat, in the case of the Catholic Church. Sorry about that. In the case of the Catholic Church, was extremely rigid and not very pious. And it was against a lot of the teachings of the Bible.
Yeah.
And one thing that you see is that a lot of people took Martin Luther's preachings, essentially, against the Catholic Church and went with it. So the biggest revolt in European history prior to the French Revolution was the German Peasant Revolt, which occurred in the early 16th century. I can't get you an exact date because I don't remember. But this was during Martin Luther's time. And they were taking his teachings and said, we're going to create the world of the equal here. All people deserve to learn the Bible. All deserve salvation. All, like, a radically egalitarian
position. Wasn't that had to do with the church selling
indulgences? Yeah.
Indulgences, right. Yeah.
Which is a way to tax people for basically trying to get their friends and relatives into heaven, for example,
or your out sins. You can buy out your sins. It's like fasting. Well, it's like a fasting slip.
Yeah.
You don't have to fast. You just get like a receipt for fasting or something.
It's worse than that because it's essentially they're talking about purgatory being a place where you're tortured for a while before you go to heaven, and you can shorten it by paying the church money. And it's a good deal. He didn't like it much. But the point of it was Martin Luther, because, and people talk about this, perhaps was it strategic or was it because he actually believed it? He argued to kill the peasants who followed his teaching like mad dogs. He argued that the princes should kill them all. And why is that? They took up his ideas. It's a strategic person would say he wanted to convert the princes first. He was looking to convert the power structure first.
Also, the peasants can't afford the indulgences.
No, but he doesn't want indulgences. He hates indulgences. Martin Luther was all against that. Like, again, his preachings were...
What's the Edict of Worms? Is that him?
It's against him, basically.
Against him.
Right. So basically, I think it was Charles II, the Holy Roman Emperor / King of the Catholic Church and all of the Americas. He gathers this one rebellious priest and he gets all his like lawyerly like experts in religion together to like beat him, so that like he could publicly humiliate Martin Luther. Basically, he doesn't want to kill the guy. He wants to
go. Question. Sorry? I have a serious question for both of you.
Yes.
Do you think that these religious figures on both ends, the powerful and the rebellious, to what degree do you think they actually believed in these doctrines? And to what degree do you think that they were economically motivated or politically motivated or personally motivated for whatever gain?
Well, I would say it's a complicated relationship depending on the person. I would say it's a lot like politics today, where people have their political ideology, but a good player can set aside it somewhat. Like, it's the goal, but they have all of their like ways of getting it done, essentially. And a lot of them are self-enriching. And some people don't care at all, and they're just about self-enriching. We have like a bunch of cases of people like making themselves like Littlefinger, these like easily, they'll flip to the next person easily. They just make themselves useful to whoever's
like, is Trump a real representative of Christianity? Like, so we're talking about figures like that, and we're taking them very seriously, is my point. What do you think, Obama?
I don't know. I think they do believe in what they're doing, but I think they're cherry picking. I think they're cherry picking in that, like, because, like, here's the thing, at least the way I see it, the Bible is huge, right? It's a lot. It's a lot of words. It's a lot of pages. There's a lot you should know, right? And so I think what ends up happening is that they'll cherry pick, or like they'll just focus on the parts that serve them, and then they just go with it. But they do believe it. Because I don't think people, especially at that time, I doubt people really didn't believe because religion is central to people, especially at that time, right? And it's very important to them. It's like, how do I say this? It's like, you know, it's like, how important was religion? Some people will say that prophets were, you know, they're just people who were, I guess, exploiting, or not exploiting, but they were like taking advantage of a social situation and you know what I mean, right?
We know what you mean, but like...
Yeah, but like, I do think they believed it, yeah. Martin Luther, 100%, I do think he believed in what he was saying, yeah, and what he was preaching. Because it does come out of like real genuine frustration, right?
Here's the thing. Different people have their religions. Like, for example, like their core beliefs. Some people have the religion of the self, where it's just about like making themselves more powerful and more richer and healthy, like everything else. But most people have also what they actually believe in. So like a lot of people who pretend to be nihilist or whatever, well, if you know where to poke, you'll find the right thing, and that they find sacred, you know? Everybody has their version of the sacred. of the thing that they hold dear. And no matter how much a person likes to be like a teenage boy who doesn't believe in anything, it's all about, you know, the memes and the trolling, they do have what they will get offended by.
Yeah.
And they people being cognizant of what that is actually a very big part of being mature and actually understanding what the world is and what your view of the world is, I think.
What do you think?
I have no idea.
No?
I'll say this. I don't believe for a second Trump believes in any kind of religion other than his own ego and everything that makes him feel more powerful. Like, I think he actually does believe in all that genetic stuff that he talks about all the time, because he thinks that being a German is superior in some ways because he grew up in the 50s and that was like around, and he likes the idea that he's superior.
I don't think so.
No, he talks about it all the time.
But yeah, he does, but like...
Why do you think he had those quotes on his bedside? I was thinking about Ramses.
And like, I was in Abu Simbel and I was thinking about Ramses the second. Yeah. And I was reading the glyphs and I was thinking, like, does he actually believe in this? Because a lot of his actions would go against, would like send him directly to what, like to essentially to chaos. So yeah. Does he actually believe this, or is he?
I think he does.
But
because like, here's the thing. It's not, but even then, because he probably has a goal in mind. It's like with Christianity and Rome. Rome adopted Christianity and had this vision of having a unified world under a Christian vision, right? Where this is God's kingdom on earth, and this is what, right? And we're all bound together by this one creed, by this one religion. However, in order to reach that, you have to do some nasty stuff, right? You have to go about and do some things that you shouldn't be doing.
Which will be forgiven.
This justifies it, because at the end of the day, what we're trying to achieve here is God's kingdom on earth, right?
True.
Right.
And they see themselves
as
like...
That's a good point. It's a really good point.
That is true. And like, let's take like two examples from like American Christianity, which I think is one of the more unique Christianities in the world. And that one that people would be very familiar with, I think. So you
capitalist
have
Christianity.
There's an official name, the prosperity doctrine, or the doctrine of prosperity, something like that.
Yeah.
Essentially that being rich is a sign of God's favor, and you can like, they put a holy emphasis on money, which is so antithetical to Christ's teachings that it's basically heretical by any definition, but it's a very, very, very popular version of Christianity in America, and one that serves the intellectual ego of very wealthy people and some of the poor people who want hope of becoming wealthy one day. And there's like this cultural milieu of connecting money with status, with holiness, with all of these different things that isn't, which is antithetical to Christianity. So
sounds like Rome.
Yeah, well, in this case, do the people preaching this religion, especially the like the televangelists, like asking for people's money for God's favor and seed faith, all of that, do they really believe in Christ? I have to believe they don't, because how could they possibly believe?
So what would be the difference between those people and ancient Romans?
Yeah, yeah, I don't think these people do, but Romans and not people from that.
Atheism was actually. Why? Popular in certain eras of ancient Rome among the elites, actually. So like what we would describe as atheism, like the belief that like, oh, these traditions are a lot of nonsense, we just do them for the poor and for like the stability of society, that was actually an opinion. And it's actually shown in HBO's Rome how much that, like, the distinction between the pious and the not pious and how they would interact in the same space. Like by the late Republic, the traditions of Rome that were considered so holy, so important, were being like just blatantly like ignored by these powerful figures.
Very popular ancient Greece concept. All I do is rant about how everything's bullshit. But I think we have to really contemplate on the fact that, you know, this episode is about Christianity. And I'll bring it up again. We talked about the teachings of Christ for all of 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I, You know what? It's partly because people are familiar-ish, and it's partly because everybody forgets what he actually said.
But it's also because that's where the real differences come from. It's, you know, it's the nature of Jesus Christ. Who is he, right?
But not about anything that he preached, about the opinions of what people witnessed.
I will say he did preach.
Because his teaching was very clear. There was no room for debate. That's the whole concept.
But he was so clear about how money is like the most sinful, like the power of wealth, and is the most sinful thing in the world. And yet there are Christians who believe in Christ who will worship money and believe it's
because,
the favor of God.
Because, and this is my opinion, it's because it doesn't matter. Because as long as you believe in Christ, you're saved.
That's true. That's redemption. A very
well, as long as you go to church and do something and perform some ritual, you'll be saved.
There you go. You're saved.
That very depends. Common to Abrahamic tradition.
And this is why, like, the teachings of Christ aren't emphasized. It's because you're saved by believing in him. Mm. So what is he? So that I know I'm believing in the right thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I want to know if I'm doing it right. Who is he, right?
Yeah.
Because
he specifically said not to worship him. But
yeah. Sorry. Well, I mean, it's just like with the Prophet Muhammad. He said specifically, "I'm in the Quran." It says, "I am nothing but a man. I am just a man. I am just a man." And now, you know, he's up there.
But then again, the reaction. He's
given a much higher status than he was given during his day.
Other than Nabi, of course.
True, right? true. But it tends to be, at least in Islam, the people who want to work, like go celebrate Muhammad's birthday, for example, all of that. The people who really hate that are themselves the people perverting the religious tradition because they're taking it to a level that was never intended. So the Wahhabis, the freaking... They're the ones who are like, no, we're going to destroy the burial places of these people.
Well, this goes back to what we talked about in the beginning, the break of Christianity from Judaism. And I think that this kind of personal license to interpret came with the birth of Christianity, because Judaism is a religion that is very communal and it requires community. Whereas the Christian break
is individual,
emphasizes the individual and the individual aspect.
That's interesting because Islam doesn't, like in Islam, for example, wouldn't necessarily fit into either camp neatly.
No, not really.
I would say that I don't know. What would you say?
It shifted. It started out as communal, and then when the empire was, let's say, more prosperous,
individual,
it started to focus on individual. That's where you have Sufism and all that.
I think it's very communal. I think they saw the pitfall of Christianity and basically the destruction that came with the power of the individual and had to pull back into the communal.
For a period of, I believe it was like 200, 300 years, it was very individual. I mean, especially when Sufism was around, it was very, but then colonialism happened. And as a reaction to that, it went back into the communal, but very, really deeply, because because colonialism came and then it started, let's say, bashing on Muslims, and then Muslims as a backlash was like, okay, you know what? This is who we are. We are this community. This is what we do distinctively. And you guys are not like us. And it's the same thing in the beginning when the Muslims were not conquering, but let's say they were taking over the Middle East. At some point, they had to distinguish themselves from other religions. And so that's when they went, that's when it was communal. But then when the empire prospered, okay, individualism kind of rose.
But I would say this, and we're going to get to this in future episodes, the desire to make a community itself meant there had to be some sort of leadership and organization of that community, and that itself became a contentious subject almost immediately.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
but
how would you pick your leadership?
This is Arab tribal politics. It's,
yeah, but it started off almost democratic in that you would elect your leader, and then it like through a series of wars, ended up in the worst possible place where you just have another emperor. Like you just had another emperor.
Yeah,
effectively. And I think we should start wrapping.
We'll wrap it up right now. Yeah.
Well, okay. I think this was a really, really good episode because Iman brought a lot of the interesting questions that we have. Like you answered a lot of interesting questions we have about what Christianity looked like, why, where, how. This sort of where did this? How did this little tiny event in the grand scheme of things, historically speaking, explode into the largest religion in the world? The largest religious tradition in the world, and one that would influence the second largest tradition in the world, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
And it's interesting to see how the differences between the different three major Western religions, which are Judaism, Christianity, Islam, how they play out and how their similarities.
They're born out of the same tradition, the Abrahamic traditions, right?
It's born out of the Semitic religions, in fact.
Yeah.
Which is interesting of the tribes of the Semites of the Middle East.
He's our patriarch, all of our religions. Ahl al-Kitab. Like, that's exactly the concept of why our religions are, why we can intermarry.
Mm. Yes. Oh, to depending on who's asking.
Well, no, but you could Ahl al-Kitab. That's what it is, right?
Well, it's a one-way relationship in that sense, isn't it? We're not going to get into that. But when it comes to men, yes, you can marry whoever, pretty much.
Yeah.
But that's the rule for all of them at this point. So, you know.
Yeah, but just to wrap up this episode, this is basically the story of Christianity and how it was born. You know, how it was born out in the Middle East, how it developed. We spoke a lot about at the end. I like our little discussion at the end about if they really believed in this, right?
Yeah, and I guess we were discussing.
I still don't know.
I guess we were also discussing how this would impact the Arabs, and it's essentially that like this is the main way that they would be brought into the Roman world. Prior to this, it was basically trade and like fighting with what was the now power of Syria. But the Arabs would now have this religious, some of the Arabs at least, would have this religious connection to Rome that made them sort of a waypoint between the more traditional people to the south and the Roman Empire to the north. So there's this like continuum of cultural exchange that's happening throughout this area. And the same thing on the eastern side, where the Christians of Mesopotamia would be the halfway point between the Iranian cultural tradition and that of the Arabs. And this cultural tradition would seep down through the peninsula and influence the world that the prophet was born into.
100%. And this is exactly...
Yes and no, because there were Christian kingdoms in Yemen as well that came from East Africa. So I don't know that it trickled down.
One thing that did trickle down is eschatology and how Christian eschatology influenced Islamic eschatology. Sorry?
Eschatology.
Yeah, sorry, eschatology. How it influenced, because if you look at Islamic traditions, you also have the second coming of Jesus and, you know, and all of these... Right, all of these beliefs about the end of the world and how this trickled down, you know, from Christianity and it got into Islamic traditions. But this is for another episode.
Absolutely, but
because I feel
people will make that debate
on this one.
Well, look, people will. I just gotta say this: people will make that argument, sure.
Yes.
But as an archaeologist and as somebody that focuses on the ancient histories of that region, I can't overlook that those traditions existed in those indigenous cultures for thousands of years.
Yeah, well, what I was referring about was specifically, but you know what? I'll keep it for another episode because then we're gonna have a debate on
keep
this.
Keep people on their toes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because I know because this is gonna be a debate between Iman and Oban.
Fine. I can take a break. Ugh.
Yeah. So yeah.
All right.
So, you know, we hope you guys enjoyed this episode.
Our next episode is going to be on Gnostic religions and the very interesting, Iman's currently dancing in the screen right now because she's really excited by that prospect. So the Gnostic religions are those that don't get a lot of press, but are still
very important,
very influential. Many groups in the Middle East continue those various, very diverse traditions of Gnostic beliefs. And those beliefs definitely influence both Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So it's very important that we discuss them, and especially as they relate to the Arabs and the wider Middle East. So that's the next episode, the Gnostics, the Sabians, as we call them in this episode, yeah. I think. We'll pick a name.
The Sabian, yeah.
The Sabain.
Anything you want to add, Iman?
No, but thank you for having me. And that was really fun to talk about. And I really look forward to Gnosticism because it's super fascinating and has to do with all the esoteric traditions, the Kabbalah, the Sufis. These are the esoteric traditions behind the religion. So it's much more of like, this is where driving facts doesn't work. Because Gnostic yeah. stuff has nothing to do with historical incidences.
Mm.
So it's very interesting.
So more anyway, your wheelhouse.
Yeah. Very excited to talk about such things.
Awesome.
So we hope you guys enjoyed this episode. We hope you guys learned a few things, you know, a thing or two. And we'll catch you guys on the next episode. And in the meantime, hope you guys enjoy the music.
And follow us.
I was hoping that maybe we could introduce in this episode to our viewers that their questions are welcomed and that we will address their questions and are encouraged. And maybe we could have like separate commentary where we address the questions of our viewers directly so that, you know, we're more engaged.
If you guys are into that. I'm down for that. And I think we could post something on, I was going to plug the Facebook page, the website, the email on the website, the Instagram. Maybe we'll post a poll on the Facebook because that's where most people are.
Yeah.
And ask them. And after the Gnostic episode, we could have like a little Q&A with like.
Exactly. Yeah, we can do that.
Dozen or so. And remember, Iman reached out to us and was essentially a fan of the podcast. And now she's co-host. Yay. So.
Exactly. So also, I think people should be encouraged to ask, if you want to ask Houston a specific question because he knows all the facts, ask him directly. If you want to ask Iman a specific question? No, I think it's good, because we're all going to give a different interpretation. So
yeah, exactly.
It's cool to engage with what people want to know about and what's interesting to people, because what's interesting to us, is limited sometimes.
Exactly. Oh, and if you want to know about our personal lives, we'll edit it depending on who says and asks what. But we have each one of us has some pretty interesting stuff to say about our personal lives, especially since Iman is acting like a princess right now.
Not anymore. Not, if you look out my window, I'm in like the nastiest part of Cairo.
I'm sorry. You sent us a picture of like temples in the background with palm trees and like a beautiful like pool.
That's Cairo, bro. Like you can go from that to real third world real quick.
I'm sure. But yeah, we're going to wrap up. I hope everybody enjoys the music that we're putting in this episode. We hope you enjoyed. And remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, the website, all of it. We're really responsive. I'm really interested in hearing from you guys.
100%. We're going to be posting more episodes later around like in the month of September. So forgive us if we've been pretty busy these days.
Exactly.
So hope you guys enjoy and we'll catch you on the next episode.
Have a good time.
شيخة مالك تخيل
Hallelujah, show Hashem, Hallelujah.